everybody a happy new year and welcome back to biology. And I'm not going to talk very much about administrative matters because most of you are continuing from last semester and the setup is more or less the same. The microphone that I have today is rotten. They promised me a better one, so I hope you can all hear, but if you can't, it will get better next time, and you can always move a little closer. Now, before I start, I do have one question. A student emailed me that he was planning to take the MCAT on April 12th, which is a day when one of our exams is scheduled. How many of you were planning to take the MCAT on that day? Okay, so it's... Unfortunately, maybe it's a small number, so maybe you should speak to me individually, and but I don't think we're going to move it. Now, I want to start today by summarizing the story so far. That is, what did we figure out or learn last semester? Where are we starting from? One way to look at it is that last semester, the emphasis was on prokaryotes. While this semester, the emphasis is going to be on eukaryotes. Now, we were concerned with prokaryotes, and you might say that the main question we had last semester, was how do living things work? In particular, how does one E. coli make two? We did learn something about how one eukaryote cell makes two, but the emphasis was on bacteria and prokaryotes. Now, not only did we think about mostly bacteria last semester, but we also thought a great deal about macromolecules. In particular, how their function is embedded in their structure. We weren't interested in structure by itself, but we were interested in it in terms of explaining how the function gets done. Now, this semester, we're going to emphasize not so much macromolecules, but larger things. By which I mean organelles and structures made of several kinds of macromolecule. For example, eukaryotic chromosomes, which are made of both DNA and protein. Now, the questions that we asked last semester, we're going to ask the same ones over. But instead of asking them about prokaryotes and their macromolecules, we're going to ask more about eukaryotes and their subcellular parts. What are the questions that we asked? Two of them are the relationship of structure and function. But we were not only interested in the structure of the macromolecules, but also how they were made. So their synthesis or their manufacture was also important to us. Now, another thing we were interested in last time was regulation. We were interested in how the cell controls both the manufacture of materials, such as proteins, and how the activity of those proteins is regulated. So we were interested in regulation both of manufacture and function, and we will continue to be so. Now, there's one other issue or question that we're interested in that we talked about at the very end of last semester, and this is the question of evolutionary origin. We are not only interested in the way things are and how living things work today, but we're also interested in how they got that way, in part because that explains a lot about how they work. Now, we're going to be doing these same five questions, but applying them to a somewhat different situation. But before we do that, we want to ask, so what did we learn from asking about structure, function, manufacture, etc., of the macromolecules of prokaryotes? And in a way, you can summarize the whole thing in what Crick calls the central dogma, which is DNA makes RNA, and RNA makes protein. Now, if you think of this in terms of information flow, this means that the information in the DNA is read out to make RNA, and the information in the RNA, and here you're talking about messenger RNA, is read out to make protein. But if you're thinking of information flow, we actually have to put one more in, because DNA also contains the information for making more DNA. Now, we know when you say that DNA makes RNA and RNA makes protein, it takes more than messenger RNA to make protein. This supplies the information for the order of amino acids, but you also need the transfer RNA and the ribosomal RNA to actually read out the message and make the protein. Now, we talked a good deal about these three. We now know that there are other RNAs, mostly very small ones, that are involved in regulation through the phenomenon we called RNAi, or RNA interference. Now, we talked about this a little last semester, largely as a laboratory tool. This has turned out to be an enormously important, useful tool in the lab, and the recent Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine was given for the discovery of RNAi. But we are only now just discovering how this is involved in the natural regulation of cells. And if you take development or other advanced courses, you will learn more about how RNAi is involved in the functioning of living things. Now, this picture shows you the information flow, but it doesn't really emphasize one fact part of this that I think is important, which is that although DNA makes RNA and RNA makes protein, it is protein that does all the work. And we spent a lot of time last semester explaining how a protein could do something, in particular, how a protein could act as an enzyme to catalyze a particular reaction. Now, of course, proteins do other things, but this is the function of protein that we emphasized. This semester, we'll talk more about some of the other jobs that protein can have. Now, this is really the big picture as of last semester. What about this semester? Well, there's one thing about this perhaps we didn't say, which I should mention, that not only were we interested in these questions, but we were interested in the methods that people use in order to find out about structure, function, manufacture, regulation, etc. And this next semester, we'll be interested in the same questions, but we'll be concerning a different set of methods. We'll be talking about the old ones, but we'll also be talking about new ones. Because in fall semester, what we were doing, the subjects that we were covering, are largely considered to be biochemistry, genetics, and molecular biology. And each field has its own take on the subject of biology and its own methods. And this next semester, we're going to deal more with cell biology, signaling, development, and physiology. And each of these fields has its own methods and techniques, some of which we will discuss. Now, you all know what biochemistry and genetics are. Some people say that molecular biology is just biochemistry without a license. In other words, all molecular biologists are slobs, according to biochemists. A more charitable way of looking at molecular biology is it's really the area of overlap between biochemistry and genetics when you use both approaches simultaneously to get at one of these issues. Now, why are we going to be talking about cell biology, etc.? Because when you look at eukaryotes, There are two main innovations of eukaryotes not found in prokaryotes. And in order to study them, we have to consider these new fields. And the two big issues are, first of all, the eukaryotic cell itself is very different from a prokaryotic cell. Not only is the eukaryotic cell bigger, but the important thing is that it is divided by membranes into small areas or subcompartments. So compartmentalization of the cell requires us now to look at the individual compartments or parts of a cell, that's why we say larger things, and consider what does each part do and how are the functions of the parts coordinated. This was not a problem in a eukaryotic cell, which had only one compartment. The other major innovation of eukaryotic cells is multicellularity. There are unicellular prokaryotes and eukaryotes, but all multicellular organisms are eukaryotic. Now, cell biology is basically the study of the various compartments or parts of the cell and how they get it together. Signaling is really a subject you have to understand, not for its own sake, but in order to understand the other two. Once you have a multicellular organism, you have to have some mechanism for the cells in one part to send a message to the cells in another part. There's always the proverbial example, what if you meet a lion in the street? Well, that's not too likely. Maybe you'll meet a bear in the woods, or maybe you'll meet a mugger walking down the street. Who knows? But when something like that happens, your eyes have to communicate to your brain, which has to communicate with your leg muscles, or you are in deep trouble. So how do you do that? How does one cell type send a message to another cell type in another place? That's the issue of signaling. And there are actually two major kinds of communication which we'll be discussing. One is primarily chemical. And hormones are an example of a major example of chemical signalers. And the other is electrical, which is carried out largely by nerves. And Dr. Feierstein will be giving two lectures later in the course on communication by nerves. He teaches neurobiology, which is a further expansion of that subject. Now, once you understand how the parts of an organism communicate, we have to think about the two big issues raised by multicellularity. If you have a complicated organism, such as yourself, issue one is how did you build it? We know how one cell makes two, one eukaryotic cell. But suppose you start with one and you do mitosis and you have a ball of cells. How does that ball of cells turn into a complicated three-dimensional organism, a plant, an animal, a human, with different cell types specialized in the right place, etc.? In other words, how do you build a multicellular organism? This is the problem of development. And Dr. Heiklin, who teaches a course in development, will give two lectures on this subject. We had a choice between these two, which to do first. Development is how you build a three-dimensional organism, multicellular. And physiology is how you run that organism. How does it work from day to day? Whichever we do first, there's a problem about the other one. So we have to do one or the other first, and we've chosen this year, we're going to do development first, and then we're going to discuss, once you have such a complicated organism, how does it work? Now, there are many aspects of physiology which we'll be discussing. One of them will be endocrinology. Which which is the study of the various hormones and the processes which they control and how they do it. This is an aspect of the chemical communication or signaling. Then we're going to talk about homeostasis. This is a major topic or theme of physiology. When we think of how does a complex organism, not a cell, but a multicellular organism work, we tend to focus on things like running away from the mugger. How do you do that? How do you get your muscles to respond, etc.? Or we try and think, how do we turn on the computer, things like that. But an awful lot of what goes on in a multicellular organism is unconscious. It is materials which you are completely, processes which you are completely unaware of. That in order for a multicellular organism to function, it must maintain a more or less constant internal milieu. A great deal of physiology is concerned with how the cell maintains constant conditions inside so that most of your cells live out their life in a fairly controlled, constant condition. How do you keep the sugar in your blood the same? How do you keep the pH of your blood the same? How is that done? And that is the phenomenon of homeostasis, and that's what we'll be talking about a good deal of the time. Now we're going to end the class by talking about immunology. People like to divide the organs of the individual into systems which take care of some aspect of response or homeostasis or whatever. Depending on your lumper or a splitter, the number of systems is variable. But there are things like the skeletal system, the muscular system, etc., endocrine system, etc. The immune system is perhaps the most complex and bizarre of all of them. It helps defend against infective organisms, microorganisms, viruses, and bacteria. And the way it does it is both very interesting and very complicated. That's why I put it last. This is one of those subjects, like physiology, about which there is a whole semester course. So clearly we can't get to the bottom of it, but we will do a little bit. We will talk about the major themes and ideas of immunology. Now at this point, I want to stop talking about what we're going to do, and I want to actually do it. So I want to start by taking a closer look at how a eukaryote cell compares to a prokaryote, or what does a eukaryotic cell really look like? Well, how would you look at a eukaryotic cell? They are a lot bigger than prokaryotic cells, but they're not big enough to see much with the naked eye. You would have to use a microscope. So if you look in a light microscope, what do you see? If you look at a eukaryotic cell in the light microscope, you don't see very much. You can see that the cell has a central compartment separate from the others, namely the nucleus. And you can see that it has an area within the nucleus that stains very darkly. And this is named the nucleolus. Now, I've drawn a bunch of membranes here. I drew a line here separating the nucleus from the cytoplasm. And I drew a membrane or barrier surrounding the entire cell, remembering, of course, that this is a cross-section of a round cell. In the light microscope, you cannot see an actual membrane. You cannot see a structure here or there. However, you can infer that they exist because the material here is different than the material inside, and substances do not easily equilibrate across the two. So there's clearly some sort of barrier, but you can't see anything about its physical nature. Now, can you see any other structures within the cell? You can see mitochondria, which we discussed last semester, that carry out oxidative metabolism. If this were a plant cell, you could also see chloroplasts. Mitochondria are about the same size as bacteria, and a eukaryotic cell is much, much larger. Now, can you see anything else? The only other organelle that you can see within the cell is actually debatable. That is, when all we had was the light microscope, there was debate about whether it was real or an artifact. Because you couldn't see the structure very much, but with certain stains, there seemed to be something there. And that's named the Golgi apparatus after its discoverer. Now, you can see that this is not a very complicated picture because you can't see very much in the light microscope. Now, you might think that all you have to do is increase the magnification and blow it up. But if you increase the magnification, it just gets blurrier and blurrier. And this is because of a phenomenon called the limit of resolution. If you have two objects that are too close together, they appear as a single object. Now, those of you in the front can clearly see this as two. I don't know about those of you in the back. And if I do this, this is really two, but I think to some of you in the back, it probably looks like one. But if I do this, it is perfectly clear that this is two marks. The limit of resolution refers to how close you can get them and still see two. The limit of resolution determines how much you can blow things up. And it depends on two factors. It depends on the optical qualities of your instrument, and it depends on the wavelength of radiation used to illumine the object. Now, with the eye, the limit of resolution is about a tenth of a millimeter. So if things are closer than that, they appear as one object. With the light microscope, the limit is 2/10 of a micron, abbreviated with the Greek letter mu. In a minute, we will review these units and how they are related to each other. For the moment, the major point is that this is much smaller. In fact, if something that you see has a size of 1, you can magnify it about 1,000 times in the light microscope without losing resolution. You can't blow it up more than that because of the wavelength of light, not because of the microscope. So if you want to see anything more about a cell, if you want to see the parts or the organelles or the membrane, you need some technology for greater magnification. And that technology is the electron microscope, or the EM, where one uses not a beam of photons, but a beam of electrons instead. And the resolution there in practice for the ordinary electron microscope, or the transmission electron microscope, is 1 to 9 nanometers. The T here stands for transmission. There are two kinds, major kinds of electron microscope, the transmission or regular electron microscope and the scanning electron microscope. The resolution with the scanning electron microscope is less, but it allows you to get a three-dimensional image of the object. Now, the reason for that is that with the regular electron microscope, you pass a beam of electrons through your sample, just as you would a beam of photons with light. Now, you need a very thin sample, and it has to be stained with electron-dense material, and things have to be dead. So you can get better magnification, but you can't do it with live things. With a light microscope, you can actually see live cells. But if you have your thin slice of fixed tissue, when you send the beam of electrons through, where the substance is dense, less come through. Where the sample is not so dense, more comes through. So from how many electrons make it to the other side, you can figure out what's dense, what's not, and get structure. In the case of the scanning electron microscope, you irradiate your sample as an angle, and the sample emits secondary electrons, which are excited by the original beam. And what you are measuring is the scattering of the secondary electrons emitted from the sample in all directions. And therefore, you get what appears to be a three-dimensional image. There's some very beautiful examples in your books, and there is in the notes two URLs linking you. There are two links to sites that have lots of lovely pictures showing how this is used. Now, I think before we go any further, it's a good idea to go over what these units mean and how they are related. It turns out that one way to define biology is by the size of objects that biologists think about. If things get too small, it's chemistry, and if they get smaller, it's physics. If things get too big, physics again. So biology has the middle. So let's look at the units that biologists deal with. Biggest living thing you can. That means something like a dinosaur, a T-Rex, or a blue whale, something like that. The biggest living thing you can think of can be measured in meters. You don't need kilometers even to measure a dinosaur. So the biggest biological objects are measured in meters. Now, a thousandth of a meter is a millimeter, and a thousandth of that is a micrometer, or mu, and a thousandth of that, I'm going to write it up here because it's clearer, is a nanometer, and a tenth of that is an angstrom. Biologists don't worry about anything smaller than that. As I said, it's chemistry or physics. And they don't worry about much bigger than this. Environmental biologists do, but molecular biologists don't, because bigger than this is something else to worry. So if meters is what you measure whales in, how big is a millimeter? A pinhead is a few millimeters across. So a pinhead, or a small multicellular organism, is measured in millimeters. Cells are measured in microns. There are some reference numbers in your notes, so you get some idea. The typical eukaryotic cell is about 50 microns in diameter, while the typical bacterium is not tens of microns, but tenths of microns. No, it's just microns, something like 1 to 5 microns in diameter. The smallest certified living cells are about 2/10 of a micron. Now, this is pretty small. This means 200 nanometers. And to give you some perspective, how big is a ribosome? A ribosome is 25 to 50 nanometers. So you can see that a cell this size can't hold all that many ribosomes. If you get the cell much smaller than this, it's hard to imagine how it could contain all the material for transcription and translation. Now, there are some structures smaller than this, which some people think are living cells and some people are not so sure, that are called nanobes. And there is a link or two on your notes to some articles about them. So to come back to our scheme here then, microns are what you use to measure cells, and nanometers are what you use to measure cell parts. That is, organelles and pieces of cells. And angstroms are used to measure chemical bonds and very small molecules. Okay. So having said all of this, that you can see a lot more in the electron microscope then, because you have enough resolution that you can blow things up about 100 times more than you could with a light microscope. So you can blow things up 100,000x compared to the naked eye. So you get a 100-fold increase when you use the ordinary electron microscope. So what do you see if you look at a cell through an electron microscope? And this is on handout 1A. There are more copies on the... No, over there, but there's some over there. Now, I want to emphasize that the job of these handouts, as it was last semester, is largely to be defaced. That I expect you to take these out and write notes on them and not to keep them as souvenirs. If you want an extra copy, I always try to bring extras, and there will be extras available in the boxes outside my office. The only time there aren't any extras is if you come the day before the exam. Then you can't be guaranteed. Now, what does a cell look like? This is meant to be a typical eukaryotic cell. Now, remember, this is a slice through the cell. The cell was originally round, and we've made a thin slice through it. And what we're going to talk about here is what you can see when you actually look at the cell. I want to emphasize that what we're going to do today is an overview. We are going to come back and look at each of the organelles in detail later, but we want to put them all in perspective first. So if we leave out some details, don't panic, we will come back. Now, the first thing you notice when you look in the electron microscope is that the membrane, the so-called plasma membrane of the cell, is actually a physical structure which you can examine. It can't just be inferred, it is physically there. If you blow up the structure, you see something that looks, I've turned it sideways, you see what appear to be two dark layers. This is called a bilayer. Every time we draw a line, we are referring to a bilayer. Now, you can think of this as two darkly staining layers, or you can actually think of it as being a three-layered object, which is a sandwich of two darker layers sandwiching a thinner layer. And next time, we will talk in detail about the structure of this bilayer at a molecular level. We'll say for now, it's just a combination of lipid and protein, and we'll talk about the detail next time. Now, the second thing you notice is, of course, the nucleus, or major compartment. But when you look in the electron microscope, it becomes clear that there are actually two layers surrounding the nucleus, not one. Now, maybe it's easier to understand this if we think about how it was formed. If this is the nucleus, this is one bilayer. This is a second bilayer. So there are two bilayers here, two separate ones. But you see that there are holes, there are nuclear pores, allowing substances to enter the nucleus. And they are formed by making a break in the two membranes and joining the two membranes. And what you're left with is a pore. Now, a pore is not just a hole. Pore actually has a complicated structure and is selective, as we'll discuss at more length. Remember, of course, that this is a cross-section. If we had the whole nucleus, it would look sort of like an orange with holes in it. Now, inside the nucleus, you can see the nucleolus that we talked about before. And it becomes clear from looking in the electron microscope that the nucleolus is not surrounded by a membrane. It is not a separate compartment. It's instead a specialized region of the cell where certain kinds of molecules accumulate. This is where ribosomal subunits are put together. Remember, a ribosomal subunit contains at least one RNA and multiple proteins. They all get it together here. And then the ribosomal subunits exit through the pore, get it together, and act as ribosomes in translation. Translation occurs in the cytoplasm. There are ribosomal subunits being made in the nucleus, but whole ribosomes are thought to be restricted to the cytoplasm. Now, before we get to the ribosomes, we should say one more thing. You notice that because there are these two membranes, there is a space between them. And this is called the perinuclear space. Now, what can you see in the cytoplasm of this cell? One thing you see is a network of flattened sacs and tubes, and we've written a little piece of it down here. This network of flattened tubes and sacs is called the endoplasmic reticulum, or the ER. And it has two parts. If you look on your handout, you notice that there are some little dots on parts of it. And parts of it that are unadorned. These little dots are ribosomes. Some ribosomes are found in the cytoplasm. They're attached to messenger RNA. And they're making protein, but they're not attached to a membrane. And so these are called free ribosomes. While there's another class of ribosomes that are attached to a membrane. Now you notice here that the endoplasmic reticulum is continuous with the outer membrane of the nucleus. The membrane is continuous. And the space inside is continuous. Now, these ribosomes that are attached to a membrane, to part of the ER, or the outer membrane of the nucleus, these are bound ribosomes as opposed to free ones. The part of the endoplasmic reticulum that has ribosomes is called the rough ER. while the part that has no ribosomes, just membranes, is called smooth. These two are connected, and they are partially overlapping in function. The rough endoplasmic reticulum is primarily involved in making proteins that are destined for what is called the endomembrane system, not the emergency medical service, but the endomembrane. There are a bunch of membrane-bound areas of the cell which are all in communication, and so all together they're called the endomembrane system. The endoplasmic reticulum is part of it. We'll draw in the rest of it in a bit. Proteins that are going to end up either in the endomembrane system or outside of the cell are made on these bound ribosomes. So the proteins made on these ribosomes end up on the inside of the ER. And any space inside is called a lumen. So you see that the ER has a membrane on the outside and a lumen or space in the middle. And remember again, this is a cross section. So that means this is a flattened sac here. This is a tube, and we've sliced it. Now, the rough ER then is concerned primarily with protein synthesis. The smooth ER is concerned with other functions, one of them being detoxification, breaking down of noxious compounds. Another is lipid synthesis. Now, the way the smooth ER does that is there are proteins or enzymes embedded in its membrane, and their catalytic domain faces the cytoplasm. So that means that these proteins are locked into the smooth ER, but they can work on substrates in the cytoplasm. Now, the entire endomembrane system is concerned with the synthesis and packaging and sorting of proteins and getting them to the right place. In a cell as complicated as this, it's not enough to just make a protein. You also have to get it where it is supposed to go. For example, the protein which is defective in cystic fibrosis is called CFTR. And what is wrong in people with cystic fibrosis is the protein never gets where it is supposed to go. This protein is supposed to be in the plasma membrane and act as a transporter. In people who have cystic fibrosis, the protein is slightly altered. And as a result, it gets into the endomembrane system and it gets stuck. It cannot get to the right place. It cannot get to the plasma membrane. And as a result, the person has symptoms. Now, there is another example of this on the article which I handed out today, which is on the back of 1C, the overview. This is a very recent article, and I picked it in part because it talks about sorting, which is what we're going to be talking about. And partly I picked it because it uses some of the things we talked about last semester. In particular, one of the examples that was on the final exam. On the final exam, there was a problem about Cullen-Treacher syndrome and the protein treacle. In that case, what caused the symptoms was not the lack of a protein or the presence of an abnormal protein, but what caused the problem was low concentration of normal protein. Now, it appears that the protein described in this article has a very similar effect. It's a protein required for sorting. And if you don't have enough of it, then some proteins are not sorted properly. And in particular, the precursor of amyloid ends up in the wrong place, and you get too much of the protein called amyloid. The amyloid, when there's low amounts of sorting protein, the amyloid ends up in the wrong place, is degraded improperly, and jams up the cell. And this predisposes to Alzheimer's. We know that Alzheimer's is caused by a buildup of amyloid, and there are many different defects in the sorting program which have the same consequence, that you have too much amyloid because it's not properly taken care of. So let's go back and consider the other parts of the endomembrane system. The other major part is the Golgi. As long as we had only light microscopes, there was an argument about whether the Golgi was real. But we now know from looking in the electron microscope that it is a real structure. It looks something like this. Now, remember it's a cross-section. So this is a flattened sac. This is another one. This is another one. This is a little like those pizzas that have a hole in them. A hole in the middle. So this is like one hollow pizza stacked on another hollow pizza, stacked on another hollow pizza, and then we sliced it down the middle. And these stacks have varying numbers of pizzas in the stack. And they're always associated with a small number of vesicles that are thought to be involved in carrying material from one sac to another. So this is the Golgi. Now, the other part of the endomembrane system worth mentioning is there are a bunch of vesicles besides these transport and other transport vesicles. Some vesicles are associated with the endomembrane system. Now, why do I say all of this is one system? It's pretty clear from this picture that the endoplasmic reticulum is not connected to the Golgi, which is not connected to the vesicles. So why do I say it's all part of one system? Partially because material passes from one part to another, but also because we know that these parts are effectively connected, because material can be passed from one to the other. And how this works is diagrammed on the bottom of your handout. Suppose you have two membrane-bound compartments, such as the ER and the Golgi, or ER and a vesicle. But you have two separate membrane-bound compartments. How do you transfer stuff from one to the other? Well, suppose there's some stuff in this one, say a protein in here. Well, how do we get it from A to B? Eukaryotic membranes have the property that they are able to butt off. So a piece of membrane can form a bud, and then that bud can pinch off. And now the protein or cargo, instead of being in A, is in a vesicle. But just as these membranes have the property of being able to form and pinch off, they're also able to fuse with other membranes. So in the next step, the vesicle membrane fuses with B. And now if we open up this part right here, we end up with cargo or protein that used to be in A that is now in B. Now notice that this process doesn't just deliver cargo. It also delivers a little patch of membrane from cell A to cell B. This little patch over here used to belong to sell, to not to sell, but to compartment A. And now it's in compartment B. Now, on your handout, there are arrows. And it's pretty clear that what you're doing is transferring cargo and membrane from A compartment to B. But this process is really completely symmetric. If there were no arrows, which way is this going? Is the pink stuff going from A to B or B to A? If you had this bunch of pictures, you wouldn't know. You would need to, in some way, follow material from the start and see if it goes from B to A or if it goes from A to B. This group of pictures could represent either direction. Now, what we have here is moving something from one compartment in the cell to another compartment. And things can be moved from any part of what is called the endomembrane system to the rest of it using this process. But even more interesting, this same process can be used to bring things into or take them out of a cell. And this is diagrammed on your big fat cell if you look back over here. Now, which way are we going here? Is material going from A to C or from C to A? Notice that, again, you really cannot tell. Unless you had a time sequence showing one of these first and the others later, you really couldn't tell. And cells do both. Cells both form vesicles so that material leaves and pinch off so that material comes. And the ability to do this, which is actually equivalent to what we've just drawn, this is a feature unique to eukaryotic membranes and eukaryotic cells. And when it involves things going in and out of the cell, that's when it's called exocytosis, if things go out of the cell, and endocytosis if they come in. So if we start with C, suppose you have some material made in the cell. That is inside a vesicle. The vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, and then the area opens, will fusion, and now the cargo will be released to the outside of the cell. Now, if this happened repeatedly, not only would a lot of material leave the cell, which often is supposed to. For example, the protein hormone insulin is made and released this way. If you kept on doing that, the cell membrane would get bigger and bigger. Because each time you release a little cargo, you add a little membrane to the surface of the cell. But remember the opposite process, endocytosis. In a normal cell, exocytosis is balanced by endocytosis. That is the reverse process. A little bit of membrane invaginates or bends in around a little bit of outside stuff. It forms a vesicle and pinches off from the membrane. And this both removes, so this is endo versus exo. So this removes people products from the outside and moves them into the cell inside a vesicle. Now, if we come back to our ribosomes, the ribosomes that are attached to the endoplasmic reticulum make proteins that are going to end up either in some part of the endomembrane system or are going to be released to the outside of the cell, or that are going to become part of the membrane itself. What about all the other proteins? What about the proteins that are floating in the cytoplasm or in the nucleus? Those proteins are made on free ribosomes. These ribosomes make the proteins for everything but the endomembrane system and release. Now, from this picture, It looks like all the vesicles in the cell are part of the endomembrane system. But this is not true. Some vesicles in the cell are part of the endomembrane system in that proteins made in the ER end up inside them. But some vesicles get their proteins from free ribosomes and are completely different. And what I want to consider now is, how would you tell them apart? We now know that there are at least two classes of vesicles inside the cell that look very similar. That is, they are about the same size. And they look almost exactly the same. And in fact, they're about the same density as well. One of these is called a peroxisome. And one kind is called a lysosome. We now know the lysosome is part of the endomembrane system. And the peroxisome is not. Now, these are very different in that each vesicle contains a different collection of enzymes. The lysosome contains a collection of acid hydrolases. Hydrolase means it catalyzes the breakdown of macromolecules into its monomers by hydrolyzing it. Acid means that it works best at acid pH. Now, what about these enzymes? Why do you have them in a vesicle? Why not just have them floating around in the cell? Well, needless to say, if you have a hydrolase floating around, it might hydrolyze something. So these enzymes are capable of breaking down all the material in the cell. So by keeping them in a separate package, it keeps them safely away from most of the cellular material. Material to be destroyed is usually in a vesicle. That vesicle fuses with the lysosome, and now you've got the enzymes and the substrate together, and the substrate is degraded. Lysosomes degrade material largely from the outside of the cell. So something from the outside of the cell comes inside, this fuses with the lysosome, and now the enzymes of the lysosome destroy the material that was taken up. One of the other advantages of having these have an acid optimum is that if by chance one of these enzymes escapes, the cell is neutral. And so this enzyme will not work as well. So by having them work at acid condition and having them segregated, it reduces the chances that they will accidentally degrade something they are not supposed to. Now, that's lysosomes. What's with peroxisomes? Peroxisomes vary a lot from cell type to cell type. In animal cells, they contain a lot of oxidases. And these oxidize various substances. And the enzymes themselves are probably not particularly dangerous. But the reaction that they carry out generates peroxide. And hydrogen peroxide is a very reactive, dangerous chemical. So having the vesicle sequesters the peroxide, and better yet, peroxisomes contain the enzyme catalase, which breaks down the peroxide. We will talk more about the details of this later. But this is another case where you keep something dangerous inside, except what is dangerous is not actually the enzymes, but the product which they make. So it is kept inside and degraded by another component so that it doesn't get loose. Now, how do we know that these are actually in two separate classes of vesicles and they are not all together? At this point, we want to explain the two major methods that are two of the major methods that are used in cell biology. These are often called grind and find, and in situ assets. The idea of grind, these, if you have the notes, these are at the end. The idea of grind and find is that you take the cell, suspension of cells, and you break them open mechanically. And then you separate the various pieces on the basis either of size or of density. You use ultracentrifugation, which we talked about last semester. If you use velocity centrifugation, the speed with which things move down the tube depends on their size and friction. If you use equilibrium density centrifugation, that says in the Meselson-Stahl experiment, where you float things in a solution until they match their own density. So you can separate things of different size, and you can separate things of different densities. And so you can separate many of these components from each other, and then you can measure the properties of what you've got. If you have pieces of Golgi, what enzymes does it have by providing substrate and seeing if you can make product. So you can do all kinds of biochemical tests on the various fractions. So you grind it up, and you find which fraction has which enzyme. Now that allows you to do detailed biochemistry, but in the process of grinding this cell up, sometimes the pieces get mixed up, and sometimes various pieces don't separate. In fact, using that technology, you cannot separate ordinary lysosomes and peroxisomes. They have essentially the same size and the same density. It takes a trick to separate them. What you can do, though, is what is called an in situ assay. Now, that in situ means in place. The idea there is that you provide a substrate for the enzyme you're looking for. You provide a substrate which is soluble, and the substrate diffuses through the cell. But you pick a substrate that, when acted on by the appropriate enzyme, makes a product which is insoluble. So when the substrate meets the target enzyme, it's converted into product, precipitates, and sits where it was made. So product is localized at the site of the enzyme itself. Now, the trick to this is finding a suitable substrate that, when acted on by an enzyme, will make an insoluble product that you can detect. If you're using the light microscope, you want a colored product. If you're using the electron microscope, you want an electron-dense product. It's possible to provide a substrate for catalase or one of the enzymes of peroxisomes, and you find that it forms product in some of the vesicles. On the other hand, if you use a substrate for an acid hydrolase, you find that it forms product in a different set of vesicles. So from these in situ assays, you see that two different enzymes are in two different vesicles, not all mixed up. Now, there's another technology that involves using fluorescent antibodies, which we'll talk about next time. But I now want to go back and look at some parts of the cell we haven't talked about yet. We talked about the endomembrane system. We talked about peroxisomes, especially versus lysosomes. But what about mitochondria? This cell is getting a little crowded, but suppose it had a mitochondrion. Mitochondria are different from the things we've talked about so far, that is, from the ER and the vesicles, and that mitochondria have two membranes surrounding them, like the nucleus does. You notice there's an outer membrane and an inner membrane. Maybe we should blow this up a little. To having two membranes, mitochondria actually contain DNA. They contain a small amount of DNA, and it's circular. Now, in addition to having DNA, they're able to read out that DNA and make the corresponding proteins. Therefore, they have the entire enzyme set for the machinery for both transcription and translation. They contain not only RNA polymerase, etc., but ribosomes, transfer RNA, and so forth. Now, mitochondria only have a little bit of DNA, so they only make a few proteins. Most of their proteins are made outside and imported, but they make a few of their own from their own DNA. Now, if you look carefully, you see that the ribosomes and the inner membrane are more like the systems in bacteria, in prokaryotes, while the outer membrane is more like a eukaryotic membrane. And something similar is found in chloroplasts. And so it looks to us like what these are endosymbionts. A symbiont is a parasite which is of mutual benefit between the host and the parasite. The thought is that once upon a time, a cell engulfed by endocytosis a bacterium. It happened once with one kind to give mitochondria and once with another kind to give chloroplasts. And what has happened over time is that most of the DNA here has been lost. And what has been retained is a small amount from making the proteins of the inner membrane. This is useful to the host because it carries out oxidative metabolism and provides ATP. On the other hand, it is dependent upon its host for most of its proteins and most other materials. It is called endo because it is within a cell. Now, if you look back at my picture then, I have ribosomes attached to the ER, and I have ribosomes free in the cytoplasm. Do I need ribosomes anywhere else? Well, actually, that's an interesting question. Do you need ribosomes in the nucleus? The majority opinion is no, in that you make the RNA in here, but that it goes out to the cytoplasm before it is read. That the messenger RNA has to be spliced properly in here, safely away from a ribosome, and then it's transported out through the pores, meets a ribosome, and gets read. So we probably don't need any ribosomes in the nucleus, but we need them somewhere else. Is there any place else there's DNA? Remember the mitochondria. The mitochondria make some proteins of their own, and therefore there is a third kind of ribosome in the mitochondrion. Remember, it is the prokaryotic type, slightly smaller, slightly different, but there are actually three locations then of ribosomes. As we've mentioned, the ribosomes on the ER make material for the endomembrane system, the plasma membrane, and for outside. The ribosomes in the mitochondrion and the corresponding ones in the chloroplast make a few of their own proteins. The free ribosomes, then, make the proteins for the cytoplasm, the nucleus, the peroxisomes, everything but the endomembrane system, and most of the proteins of the mitochondrion are actually made on free ribosomes. So these proteins are made outside the mitochondrion and shipped in afterwards. And we will consider in some detail in a while how you do all of this and coordinate it. Now, what I want to talk about for the last few minutes is one more component of the cell. But let me ask first if there are any questions about the material so far. Is this a universal cell structure? This is general for virtually all eukaryotic animal cells. Plant cells look a little bit different. There are pictures in your book. However, you've made a good point. The different cells are specialized for different purposes. And there really is no typical eukaryotic cell. And depending on what the cell is specialized for, certain parts of this will be larger and certain parts will be smaller. Cells that secrete a lot of protein have lots and lots of rough ER. Cells that make a lot of steroid hormone have lots and lots of smooth ER, and so on. So each specialized cell type is a variation on this. Yeah? How would you tell there are two different enzymes in the two? Nothing that I've said tells you how I know that this is part of the EMS and this is not. In order to do that, you have to trace newly made material. Where does it go? And you can show that the peroxisomes get their protein from here and the lysosomes get it from here. Okay. Now, the one other part of the cell that I want to talk about is the cytoskeleton. And there's a table on the other side of, on 1B, which summarizes the major features. We're not going to do most of this, but we're going to, today, we're going to explain what these various components are for, and then next time, please bring back this table. We'll go over the table and the structures of the various types of parts of the cytoskeleton. The cytoskeleton consists of three major different types of fibers or filaments. We want to consider first, what is its function? It's called a skeleton because it has a function similar to the skeleton of a body. And that is, it serves the function of holding things up. It provides strength, and it determines, to some extent, shape. Some cells have very small protrusions. So if you make a cross-section, the cell looks like this. The cytoplasm is pushed into these little finger-like projections, thereby greatly increasing the surface area. What holds these little fingers up are the fibers of the cytoskeleton sticking out into each little protrusion. Just as with a regular skeleton, it provides a framework or a scaffolding for localizing various materials. People used to talk about a cell as being a bag of enzymes. We now know that's not true at all. That the cell is very highly organized, and each of the organelles is localized and pinned down in a particular part. And the reason we know this is that if you add drugs and allow the cytoskeleton to fall apart, then what happens is these various organelles tend to fall apart and mush all over the cell and spill their guts. So that what's holding them in place is attachment to the cytoskeleton, which is acting sort of like a pegboard or one of those lattice works on which to tie down the various organelles and parts of the cell. And smaller parts are probably tied down as well. Specific messenger RNAs and proteins may be attached at different points. And the final thing, which is a function of the cytoskeleton, is to allow movement. There are two basic kinds of movement to think about. In one, the cytoskeleton acts as a kind of road or a kind of railroad track, and that you have a fiber and things are moved along the fiber. And they do that because there are things called motor proteins and the motor protein attaches on one side to the vesicle that's being carried, and on the other side, it attaches to the piece of the cytoskeleton. and it uses the energy of breaking ATP to move down the track. For those of you who saw the movie about the cell, the animation of the inside of the cell, you may remember one of the things is there's a large vesicle, and it's attached to something with 2 feet, and they go down the cytoskeleton. That's what you're looking at. The other kind of movement involves the sliding of 2 fibers past each other. This is what allows muscle to contract or shorten, and this is what allows cilia and flagella to beat, because as one moves, it pulls the other one. Now, what happens there is either there is a motor molecule in between the 2 fibers, or one of them is a motor molecule, so that one of them changes conformation by splitting ATP and allows the other to move relative to it. So what we'll do next time is we will talk about the various pieces of the cytoskeleton and how they carry out their function and the structure of membranes. I have with me the exams from all 3 sections. If any of the TAs are here, I'd appreciate it if they come forth and help me, and I will go through them. I'll start with the F class, and then the C section 2, and then C section 1.
All right. Let me just turn this off.